This is Terry Crosby,
Andy Steiger,
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. We are delighted that you are joining us today.
It's good to be back, Terry.
Welcome back, guys. We took a little break over the summer.
Mm-hmm. Steve, you had a good vacation?
I didn't have much of a vacation because I was busy getting the house in order. but I had lots of help from my family here. So my father-in-law, my brother-in-law, my mother-in-law, all the in-laws kind of came together to help me cut down this massive tree that's diseased in my backyard and get the garage up and running. All that kind of stuff.
You were telling me that you have homeowner hands now.
Yeah, never done this before. So I'm just a rookie, just groping my way around the house, trying to figure out how this thing works.
Attaboy. For those of you who don't know, Steve Kim has moved to Edmonton. He's still with Apologetics Canada and doing great work out there. If you're in the Edmonton area or in Alberta in general, give him a shout. Steve@apologeticscanada.com. He'd love to hear from you and connect with you.
Yep.
Well, everything's wrapping up. We're wrapping up again here to do weekly podcasts. We missed a few during the summertime, but we are back. Ministries are wrapping up. You got your young adults.
Yeah, let's not talk about that.
Okay. I got a little something for you this week.
You been digging, Terry?
A little. It gets sent to me by Twitter.
So how does it get sent to you? Do you follow something?
They just tell me that there's new tweets from different people.
Right? Oh, okay.
And this one's from This Week in Church Signs.
Okay, Church Signs.
Church Signs. All right. You see this posted outside a church on their signage.
Which, around our community, there are all sorts of stuff that get put on signs. In fact, I've had many people text me images of signs they've come across, and I still just can't fathom how these signs and the things that get put on them work their way there.
Yeah. And is it effective?
That's a big question for me. Yeah. Does it actually work?
Does it actually work? Well, I have a few for you that is grouped with their reference to secular songs.
Okay, so now did the church do this or you did this?
The church did this.
Okay.
So this is on their signage outside the church.
So this is what they're doing that's kind of trying to
draw me in.
Look how culturally astute
that's
I am.
That's right.
All right.
Okay,
let's see how culturally astute these actually are.
The first one, I'm all about that grace. About that grace, no devil.
Now, that one I absolutely...
You've heard before.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All about that bass.
Yeah.
Which I just got to get a plug quick here. If you've never listened to the Postmodern Jukebox,
yeah,
that is a must listen. And I remember I introduced Steve to that, and he thanked me profusely.
Love it.
But particularly this song, All About the Bass, on Postmodern Jukebox, now that's some good listening.
Yeah. So the actual words are, I'm all about the bass, about that bass, no treble. So that's from Meghan Trainor. Second one, Kiki may not love you, but Jesus does.
Kiki. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on that.
So this is a reference to a song from Drake, our Canadian rap artist. And his Kiki, how he spells it, is K-I-K-I. But this church spelt it K-E-K-E. So they didn't even get it right.
They were close.
They were close.
Almost culturally astute.
Almost. Okay. Third one. Watch me whip. Watch me nay. Watch me kneel. Watch me pray.
Oh, dear.
I mean, the song goes on going, ooh,
you know
watch
what?
Me. Watch me. Ooh, watch me. Watch me.
That one, I may attend that one, that church, just because of that song. Now, my kids are all about the nay.
Yeah.
They think that's hilarious.
Yeah, a lot of people do. Bring your sin to the altar and drop it like it hot.
Is that how they, like it hot?
Like it hot. That's how it's put on the... That's from Snoop Dogg and Pharrell. Not a great song. Like, you know, to be referencing, honestly.
Yeah, you have to think about that, don't you? What is actually the context Yep. I mean, what about the all about that bass? I mean,
exactly.
Okay.
Okay. The fact there is a highway to hell and only a stairway to heaven say a lot about anticipated traffic numbers. That's a long one. And they didn't even grammatically
say
a lot.
That's actually kind of clever.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it, although...
Would it draw you into the church?
Yeah, no. Church signs in general
do
not.
Would you stop right then and go...
Do you know what's interesting? Even the sermon on a church sign doesn't necessarily... You know, the sermon title, I don't even know if that would draw me in. Church signs in general just do nothing for me.
Yeah.
I've seen one church sign with the sermon title that said... This week's topic, hell, all welcome.
Sometimes you got to think about, the sentence that you're crafting there.
Yeah. I just got to give you one that I think is hilarious. It has nothing to do with songs. It's Lent. Get your ash to church.
Oh my.
All right, I'm coming to that church. That's fantastic.
That has been one of the funniest ones I've seen in a long time. Oh man, that's good. That's good.
Well, what do you got for us today, man?
Well, we are going to dig into a couple articles. One we have by Rod Dreher, Losing Marriage, Losing the Faith.
Now, this is the guy who wrote the book, The Benedict Option.
And then we're going to talk a little bit about a book by Mary Eberstad, How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. In the first article, Losing Marriage, Losing the Faith, he talks about two assumptions, and maybe just start the podcast off by talking about those. He says it's consistent among evangelicals 18 to 25. And he says that, number one, marriage is an optional lifestyle choice. Do you guys, see that around? You hear that from others, young adults these days?
Well, I can see why they would think that. I mean, this was a comment left by one of the readers who read Rod's interview with John Stone Street from the Colson Center. And he talks about what evangelicals his age, 18 to 25, what they think about marriage and things like that, that basically it's an optional lifestyle choice. I don't know if you mentioned the second assumption there, but the second assumption was children aren't an essential part of marriage, so on and so forth. I'm not sure that this is as prevalent among evangelicals than, say, their secular counterparts. But I can kind of see where it comes from, because I know when I was attending Bible school, there was such a focus on including people, especially the singles, right? Because the church culture tends to revolve around married people and families and things like that. Often single people feel left out. But then that could easily lead to this sort of idea that marriage is somehow optional or secondary or unimportant.
It's interesting that theologically speaking, that is what marriage is. Marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman. Marriage does not theologically require children, for example. Right? You don't need to have children to be married. The problem that I see, though, so often is that marriage, first of all, is seen, absolutely, I think it's seen as an option. Now, the truth is a lot of young people, though, would say to you, I want to be married, but I haven't found the right person. Now, that could be a whole nother topic, of discussion. One thing I don't quite understand, but it does seem as though people have really high standards, or it's as though young people have these really high expectations of a spouse, but the older they get, those expectations start to normalize, right? Now, we might say it's settling, but I don't actually see it that way. It seems as though it's just becoming more realistic. And I can't help but wonder if in some ways if that is why young people, you know, are often wait so long to get married. Now, truth is, though, man, I was meeting some people this summer that were older and they got married older. I mean, we've seen people marry later in life for a long time. This isn't like a new thing. So again, so just to make that point, I think a lot of people want to get married. They haven't found that right person. However, when they do get married, children is not often seen as a good thing in that marriage. And in fact, I officiated a wedding this summer. In my officiating, I talked about how great marriage is and how excited this couple is to have children, right? And some people came to me afterwards and was like, that was so refreshing. I've never heard that before, right? In a wedding, that this couple is not only excited about getting married, but they're excited to have children and start a family. And so this is one of those things where
I think I know the couple you're talking about, and they like want 10 or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Which I think is great. And it's like, well, why don't we see that more often? Now, you know, again, back to that theology, theologically getting married, you know, doesn't necessarily involve having children. And there are some people that can't have children, right? But what I would say, though, and what I would argue, though, is that the willingness to have children should go hand in hand with marriage. And I think that this even just, and we've talked about this before, it really even flows out of the doctrine of the Trinity itself. So maybe it doesn't flow out of the doctrine of, say, marriage, but it does flow out of the greater kind of view of a Christian worldview of family, that you are uniting in marriage for the purpose of starting a family, and that from that love, you know, that relational love that you have between you and your spouse isn't an insular love, but one in which brings forth life and invites others in. So I would argue that that's not just inviting children into that relationship, but even inviting other people into that relationship in the sense of a greater community, a greater, you know, a family where you respect and you value, honor that larger family unit, which often isn't the case in our culture today.
So Rod Dreher actually had an interview with the person that Terry mentioned earlier, Mary Eberstadt. She's a cultural critic and a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. She wrote a number of books, but the most recent one, I believe, is her 2013 book called How the West Really Lost God. There, she actually offers a different theory of secularization, because typically the traditional theory of secularization, especially as put forward by secular academics, is that as the culture becomes more educated and more affluent, people in that society become more and more secular. But what Mary Eberstadt is saying is, when we look at the data, the demographic data, it just, that data just doesn't fit with the theory.
Which is fascinating, by the way, because what ultimately Mary is arguing is that the data shows that the correlation with secularization is actually to do with the family unit and the health of the family.
I mean, she says a small percentage of what keeps evangelical Christianity going is the inflow is very little from new converts from other religions, but there's a huge percentage of it coming from the faith being handed down to the next generation.
Which is interesting. When you look at the stats, evangelicals are kind of holding steady, a slight incline in those coming to faith. So it's not declining, but it's only like plus 1.3% growth. Now, you compare that to others, say like the Catholics, which is the greatest decline. And you know, in one sense, you could be like, well, it's great. You know, the evangelicals are holding steady, but it's not great, you know, what we're seeing. And one of the things that we're realizing is, and we've known this and we've talked about this a lot on this podcast, is the importance of having children. You know, and in particular, your value of having children, and then your value of bringing those children up in the faith. Now, in church work, I can tell you firsthand that we see a lot of people come to church, church I'm at here at Northview, see a lot of people come to church, particularly those who maybe have left the faith. They will come back when they get married, and in particular when they have children, they will come back. And one of the things you hear over and over again is, right, people need help raising their children, but B, they want to instill in their child a good moral ethic, and they see church as a place in which to do that.
Yeah, I think I've seen the same thing as you, as these people that have been in the church at a younger age go away from the church, and when they have kids, they come back. And Mary Eberstein says that's a draw for the families, the mother and the fathers, to bring them into this moral landscape that they can raise their kids in. So it's a draw for them to come back in that sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. And my experience bears that out too, because I know for myself that it was a lot harder to motivate myself to attend church on a Sunday when I was single than now that I have kids, especially, right? Because I'm thinking now it's not about me anymore.
Well, this is one of the things that Eberstadt brings up that I think that we have to, you know, really give some thought to, and that is how important the family dynamics are in the traditions that you learn, and one of those traditions being the faith of that family. And so when a family is healthy, that family is raising children and bestowing upon those children their beliefs, and then that gets incorporated into that child and brought with that child into their family and continues to grow like that. But the challenge though becomes when you have a society with so many fractured and broken relationships that no longer is taking place. It's kind of interesting, by the way. I think the stats are that 40% of births are to single parents, if I understood that correctly. Now, one of the things I found fascinating in that is when Nancy and I, my wife and I, had our second child, William, I still vividly remember how excited the nurses and doctor was that they were participating in the birth of a normal, healthy family, that there was a father there, and that they were married, and that things were healthy, and they already had a child. This was an anomaly. And not only could you see it in their face, but they told us so, that they hadn't seen one of these kind of births in a long time.
Eberstadt says that this is the birth of a child is a powerful way that brings people back to the idea of God.
I thought that is a fascinating and important point. Now, because let's just tease that out for a moment, because when I was talking about the family dynamic and how religion is something then that you are being steeped in as you're raised within that family, what she's getting at is such an important concept, that there are other things that you're being steeped in alongside of that religion that's being taught to you. And one of the things is the birth of a child. So the parents are experiencing bringing forth life into this world. Other children that are in that family, they are witnessing that as well. But now as that family ages, you as a family go through these different milestones as a human being. You go through those milestones of having a children, but then seeing that child raised in a larger family context, you go through those milestones of, you know, there's a while where you go through a lot of weddings and it transitions into going through a lot of funerals, right? But in a larger family unit, those sorts of things are taking place all the time, and you're needing to process that. You're needing to process that there's life and there's death. And how are you going to understand and deal with those realities? And that religion then becomes the fabric within that family that's helping you process that. And one of the things that she says that we know is that there's no atheist in a foxhole. And so what happens that she's arguing is in a fractured, broken family, you're not actually seeing an accurate representation of the fullness of life. And it's easy, and then in a broken relationship, in a broken family, it's easier to be an atheist.
Yeah, I find that when I talk to people that are not believers, This is also the case for some Christians too, but I find that especially people who don't believe in God and have this sort of a naturalistic view of the world, right? This world is all there is kind of thing. I often find that they haven't really thought deeply about the issue. I mean, obviously some atheists and agnostics, you know, they've thought about this stuff a lot, but then there are people that are not particularly just, they just have drifted away from all things religious. I find that when I talk to some of these people, often they don't really, they're so focused on getting through sort of the daily routines and things like that. When I talk to them, they haven't really thought about what is beyond. And I think with something like the birth of a child and death in the family, now they're starting to look beyond just what is right in front of them and start thinking in bigger picture kind of a way.
Well, Steve, even the way you said that, I think that's so interesting, this idea of less religious. When you start to think in that way, what you begin to realize is that things are religious that you perhaps had never thought of, such as the birth of a child is a religious experience to the death of a loved one. One of the things that Ebert said writes is, that's part of why Western society is less religious than it used to be, I believe, because if it's hard to be an atheist in a foxhole, it's also hard to be one in the nursery, say, or when contemplating an open grave. The fact that so many Western people are alienated in different ways from these primal experiences is part of what's going on in so-called secularization.
I remember my first primal experience that she's talking about there was when my grandfather passed away just before I came to Canada. It was October of 1993. It was just a couple months before we came. That's when my grandfather passed away, and I remember very clearly waking up to people crying. My stepmom came into the room and told me, "Hey, your grandpa just passed away." Just the tradition in some parts of Korea is that you actually keep the body of the deceased behind this screen for a couple of days, and then you put this person in the coffin. And so I remember after a couple of days, the screen is removed and my grandfather is now being put into the coffin, and I saw his dead body there, and oh man, the kinds of things that went through my mind, and it definitely went beyond just what was right in front of me, right? Just the routine that I had to get through. Nothing was routine about this, and all of a sudden, I am asking myself the questions about what is beyond this world? Is there anything? If there is anything, where is my grandfather? If there's nothing, is this it? All kinds of things. I find that death particularly has a way of shaking people up, waking them up to the reality of what might lie beyond just this life.
Well, it's interesting to me as well to think on that note, Steve, that euthanasia plays an interesting role in this, that instead, in the past, you had to walk through suffering with people, and as they were dying, you had to care for them and mourn with them. But more and more these days, it's so easy for somebody to get a prognosis in which, or just have given up on life, and for whatever reason, have just said, yeah, I'm going to just end my life, right? So it just becomes this pill that's taken. Mm-hmm. So that they just are, you know, they no longer exist, and you have to, you know, you might have to be a part of a funeral, but that's about it. And it's interesting as well in a broken relationship, so that if you're not in a family, maybe you're estranged from your family, well, you're going to be separated from a lot of that loss. So Aunt whoever dies, well, you don't really have to be involved in her funeral. Or maybe it's a parent that you're no longer seeing, yeah. or a brother or sister that you're no longer in touch with. These are all aspects of the breakdown of the family unit that is actually separating you from reality.
I was definitely fortunate enough to grow up in a larger family. And so I've seen the passing of my grandfather and then my father. And then most recently, earlier this year, my grandmother, right? Although I wasn't there to actually see it, And so as these things are happening in my life, I've had more chances of seeing these things or experiencing these things, albeit by proxy on some of them. So that really keeps me grounded, gets me contemplating on what might be behind this reality.
Well, it's interesting, though, that Aberstad would follow that up, though, and say, even in our 21st century mindset, even going into marriage, that you and I have a very different way as people living in the modern era of viewing marriage than people would have in the past, where marriage was seen as something more permanent than it is seen today. So your brother or sister-in-law, you would have seen them as family more so in a way than necessarily we tend to, in that because divorce is so much a part of our culture, my sister-in-law or brother-in-law, it's like, well, I may be, you know, your brother or sister-in-law in the future. Hard to say, right? Like, will your marriage survive? Will my marriage survive? So we have less of this idea that they are a part of my family than we would have in the past, where that family unit, again, is a much larger circle than it is today.
Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate that so many people getting married, it seems to me that they go into it with this mindset of, in the back of their minds, it seems to me that they leave that possibility open, the possibility of, well, we might separate one day. It is an option. Not that, you know, they're thinking about this consciously going into it, but that is so much of the culture that they imbibed going into this marital covenant, right? And so, you know, I'm not trying to toot my own horn or anything like that, but one of the things that my wife and I very decidedly verbalized and communicated was that no matter what happens, we're going to stick together, and literally leaving each other literally will not become an option. We're not even going to consider that. And so we made that very conscious decision. And again, I'm not saying that, you know, people kind of go into it with that very deliberate mindset of, okay, we'll try this out, and if it doesn't work out, we'll call it quits. I don't think anybody gets married like that, but I think maybe in the back of our minds, there's that door just kind of cracked open just a tiny bit. And I think that really should be closed all the way.
Mm-hmm.
So in a nutshell, her new theory of secularization, basically it comes down to the decline of the family means a decline of Christianity. So for the future, what does that look like for Christianity, for one thing? I know that she is Catholic, and she doesn't believe in the birth control pill. So this is a very strong issue for her, and she's very animated about it as well. So where do we go as Christians with this idea?
Well, one thing I just want to put out there as an evangelical, I really got to hand it to the Catholics. I think theologically, they have been way ahead on this topic of life and just a theology of anthropology in general.
Right, yeah.
You know, they have just been way farther ahead on this subject than we are. And I think that Christians, evangelicals in particular, haven't thought through the implications of birth control pills as we should. We haven't thought through the importance of marriage in general as we should, and just what a proper theology of anthropology, you know, of human life looks like. And I think one of the things, and you brought this up earlier, Terry, is we see in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, that we individually, corporately, male, female, were made in the image of God, and that we come into the world with dignity. So we understand that. We have this inherent value. But one of the things that has really, you know, been lost is this, is verse 28, this idea of the cultural mandate that we've been created not just with in the image of God in this idea that we've been created with dignity, but we've also been created with purpose, that there's intentionality between male and female, and this idea that we would marry and that we would procreate, and that society is dependent on the family. You know, human flourishing, society is dependent on having children and on this, the the quality of that family unit.
Do you think it's a command, though, in this New Testament context?
Well, here's my thing. I think you would have to see it as a command, in that if it's not, if humanity wasn't meant to flourish, it wasn't meant to have children in that sense, then what was the future meant to be? I mean, you start to see a much different idea of the purpose of humanity. This idea that you were created to be in relationship with God and you were created to be in relationship with people. Well, is that just Adam and Eve, you know, or was Adam and Eve meant to procreate? Well, it would seem as though God created them male and female for the purpose of procreation. Because this is an interesting concept that I was talking about, comes back to the Trinity. You see in the Trinity not a duality, you see that there is a triad, right? There's three. And that this idea that in the Trinity you see this sort of relationship embodied that is inviting others into this relationship. You even see this with God creating in the very beginning. So that there's this desire for God to even incorporate us into relationship with himself. So naturally, I think you would see that that's being duplicated in us if we're image bearers of God. You know, you ask, well, what does that look like? What does it look like to be an image bearer? What does it look like to bear God's image? And I think one of the fundamental aspects that we see in being an image bearer is the idea of family. That God, what does God look like? God looks like a family, and God's made us in that image. And I think it shouldn't surprise us then that for the health of society, you need family. Like, that's what we were made for. That's what we are.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. We're relational. With everything you said, relationships, families. But I think people would come back to you and say, you know, for New Testament times, I mean, they'd say Jesus never had kids, right? For one thing. And that Paul encouraged being single more than being married.
I think that those are great points.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's important, I think, to understand there, particularly, like, let's take Jesus as an example. I don't think that you need to have children to be a human being, right? I think that you can be a full-fledged human being without having children. But you can't have more human beings without, you know, that male-female relationship, nor can you have healthy human beings without that family unit. Do you see what I'm saying? So I think that's an important distinction to make, because we do see in Jesus that he is the fullness not only of God, but he is the fullness of humanity, right? Now, that's why, by the way, I think that you can be a married couple and not have children, for the fact that some couples can't have children. Now, I do think, though, that you have to ask some serious questions of yourself as a married couple if you choose not to have children. Now, interestingly enough, I guess one of the reasons why maybe I press that issue so much.
I guess we're coming back to those assumptions that we mentioned at the beginning, right? They don't feel that they need to get married,
right,
or have kids.
Right.
It's less of a thing for them, important thing.
And I guess why I keep pressing that, Terry, is because I once was one of those. I once was one of those people that was anti-marriage, and then I slowly became interested in marriage. And I think really, if I was to be honest, maybe I was more interested in sex than I actually was in marriage. And I just knew as a Christian, that's the only way that I could have sex is if I got married.
Yeah.
And maybe that's true of a lot more people. I think one of the reasons why birth control is so attractive is because I can have more sex without what happens because of sex. Now, after getting married, though, then I had to think through, okay, do I want to have children? And throughout my whole life, I was opposed to having children. I didn't necessarily want to bring children into a broken world. And two, I knew that children would be a challenge, and in particular, be a challenge to my autonomy and what I wanted to do. And so what's been interesting to me is to experience the blessing of being married and to experience the incredible blessing of having children and the immense blessing of being in a family.
Yeah.
I find that those things are truly wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just want to continue to praise those and argue for those things because I once had bought into the secular Kool-Aid that those things would bring you down. And now I'm realizing that that is where life is actually found.
Right.
And I feel bad for those people that don't value family.
I think there's two things that will make you more into the image of Christ. Is being married.
Dude, my young adults say that to me all the time.
Yeah.
I didn't really see myself till I got married.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And children. They hone you.
They do.
They do.
They teach you about who God is.
Yep.
And they teach you about who you really are.
Yeah.
And when you come face to face with those two things, that will change you. Now, lastly, and we don't have time to get into this too much, but a lot of people talk about the Apostle Paul and his encouragement to singleness. And I think one of the things, though, that you need to take into account with regards to the Apostle Paul in a lot of New Testament time, a lot of them saw the end was near. They had a sense of urgency that Christ would return at any moment. And they were anticipating that, and they were working diligently with that expectation, which I think is right, by the way, that we should have that sort of expectation. And I think given certain circumstances in certain missionary work, potentially, I think Paul's getting at this idea that singleness could be easier or better because having a family given certain work is going to be difficult. So I think you could see that. However, I just am amazed at how quickly people are to embrace singleness and just forget everything to do with God's plan of creating humanity and society's need for life in order to flourish. I would say then that singleness is an exception. Family is the rule.
I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking about in a previous episode when we talked about birth control and all of those things. I mean, there's always this aspect of, you know, when there is some option available, some people will opt for that out of some kind of necessity, but there will always be people that use it for the wrong reasons. For example, with birth control, there is certainly a place for that, a legitimate place for that. For example, I know some people in my life for whom another pregnancy might kill them, right? And so they have to use birth control in order to save somebody's life. But then there are people who might choose to use birth control just because they don't want to have kids, because they have some kind of selfish ambitions and all that kind of stuff. And so that's why I think this kind of a sociological issue is so challenging to talk about, because you have to generalize at some point. But as you generalize, it's hard not to step on other people's toes.
I think that's a very good point, Steve, an important one for people to understand that you and I, that we do see, you know, that this needs to be nuanced. And that's why it's so important to have a more robust theology that's looking at this, that can appreciate the distinctions there.
Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us this week. We are a little over time, so we're going to end it there. We thank you for listening, and we would encourage you to go onto iTunes and rate and review this podcast. It helps us out, knowing that we are going in the right direction and that you appreciate what the topics that we address here at Apologetics Canada. Thanks again. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.